Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, 1440p overclocking the RTX 2060. Perfect together. Ray tracing? Well, you're going to hear the numbers for that. So many new phones, including Xiaomi's foldable and a plastic Pixel 3. Samsung's 970 Evo Plus NVMe SSD reviewed and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit's This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 501, recorded on January 24th, 2019. 1440p, OC, and the RTX 2060. Welcome to Twit's This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, and today, the most GPU and weird Android phone-filled news we can possibly find. We love the consoles, we love the hardware, we love the mobile, and right now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm loving the mayhem and GPU pricing. I'm Patrick Norton from, This Week in Computer Hardware, joined, ladies and gentlemen, as always, by Mr. Sebastian Peek of PC Purr. Hey, man.
Hey, how's it going?
I am delighted to see the performance numbers for the 2060. Apparently, you finally got to finish benchmarking in sleep. Congratulations, sir.
Yep, I appreciate it. It was it's been a long journey, and I finally got some rest. But yeah, I took the 2060 through its paces at 1440. That was, you know, that's the sweet spot for like the enthusiast segment. Although the numbers, if you look at Steam hardware surveys, are still, you know, sad. 3.89% as of December, even on a 1440 monitor. Less than 1.5% on UHD, but
it's like twice where it was a year ago or two.
Yeah, I mean, the prices come down. Growth. You don't have to just get those weird, you know, like brandless monitors on eBay anymore to get that 1440p goodness like we did a few years ago, like the Korean panels and things. But, you know, but the 2060 at 1440 was kind of what they had targeted this as far as performance from the very beginning. So this really gives us a better look. And I love benchmarking at this resolution, too, because you get really nice scaling. Like, there's no real CPU bottleneck going on. This is a nice resolution to test graphics cards. And if you looked at it, pretty much like before, this is right in between a GTX 1070 and a GTX 1080 from last year. So pretty much on par with the 1070 Ti, which bridged the gap between those two last year. And as I'm going through benchmarking and was looking at all these charts, pretty much at stock speeds, that was the story. And it was, you know, we're talking about a card. Last year, the 1070 Ti was, I believe, $449. And it ranged between $450 and $500 when you could find it without the outrageous Bitcoin mining tax. Mm-hmm. And to have a card that performs at or better than that level about a year later for $100 less is nice. Like, it's one of those things where, once again, we look at the performance of this card and the price of this card, and all I can say is it's fair. It's right about where it should be. You know, we'd always love to see lower prices, but I have a feeling, right, based on, you know, some of the rumors we've already talked about, that we may be seeing that lower cost card. But overclocking is where it really got interesting. And I'm not an expert overclocker. My main goal with overclocking was to see how far I could get the core to go. And, you know, OC scanner, that would just work on core speed and doesn't touch memory. I was able to get this stable at plus 170 on the core, pushing power limit and temp limits all the way up. That actually goes higher in games. And I did overclock the memory 500 megahertz, well, 250, 500 effective. And the end result, even with that modest memory overclock, was a card that was very close to an RTX 2070. The first benchmark I ran, just kind of like validating my overclock and making sure everything was stable, was 3D Mark TimeSpy, and there it actually just edged out the 2070, which is kind of crazy. But it was just one test, and that one doesn't always translate to real-world game performance. So when I actually ran it through some more tests, it was a little bit behind or closer to tied with the RTX 2070. But it's just one of those things where it took me like no time or effort to flirt with 2070 performance levels, where we were within like a millisecond of frame times. And that's, again, coming from a $349 card. And this is the Founders Edition. This doesn't have like a big triple slot cooler or anything on it. It's just, you know, the stock configuration. So,
and I mean, to put this in perspective, in case you aren't obsessively tracking the price of cards right now, a GTX 2070 is, depending on how fancy the manufacturer has gotten, is selling between $500 at the entry level and $660 for some of the, you know, the gold plated rose gold mayhemy cards. Not that there is a rose gold GTX 2070, but flirting with 2070 performance with a modest overclock. And, you know, given how easy it was, I mean, I don't particularly think you got any bin sorted chips on that. I think it's a typical 2060 performance from what we're seeing around the interwebs. But that's, you know, that's a healthy bump in performance. That's flirting, you know, that's like 1080 Ti performance on previous gen GTX cards. You know, that's $150 worth of free GPU on there.
Pretty much, yeah. And it does seem to be kind of across the board. Like, you can expect to see boosts of around 2055. I know when I was tweeting about overclocking, Kyle over at Hard OCP responded with 2055. Like, that was the number. And I got up to 2070 because this card moves in 15 hertz increments. So that's about the boost you can expect from one of these cards if you get it and just push it a little bit with one of these utilities like Precision X or Afterburner. So
that's very, pretty very epic.
Yeah. And it wasn't like, you know, like every single game at every resolution you're going to see 2070 performance, but you can make it happen. So very impressive overall, and kind of like just reaffirm my initial findings with the card. Like, the inclusion basically says, like, this is an interesting product. I think it has kind of an identity crisis because, you know, the 1060 is such a ubiquitous gaming card. It's such a popular gaming card. It's far and away number one on the hardware survey. So the 2060 just seemed like that was going to be the heir apparent. And it comes out and it's double the performance of that card and pushing the boundaries of what you'd expect from like a mid-range card. But then the price isn't mid-range either. And that's kind of what we talked about last week too. And I'm not going to belabor the point, but essentially I was actually thinking about this and it's out of arm's reach, but I have an 8800 GTX that I was talking to the staff last night about. And back then when NVIDIA was naming their cards and then giving like appending like a performance level to the end, like GTS, GTX, GT. GT was the lower end. GTX was higher end. And then Ultra was like the overclocked version of the GTX. It's almost like we got the 2060 RTX. And then there'll be like maybe a 2060 like GTX kind of version. But then may or may not be 2060. So we're still waiting. But this card at this price has a lot of potential. And the thing to keep in mind is that the RTX 2070 is a $500 to $600 card. So you are, like you said, $150 of free graphics. That's not bad with just some simple overclocking. And we'll get into like ray tracing and all that kind of stuff in a later article. Right now I would love to see more than just Battlefield 5. I think everybody's kind of sick of seeing Battlefield 5 coverage at this point, maybe. But
There's so little to work with in terms of ray tracing. I mean, Hard OCP just did a pretty in-depth look. Battlefield 5, NVIDIA ray tracing, looking at the RTX 2060. And I'm just going to tell you, if you're really curious about ray tracing performance on the 2060, the big hint is that the frame rates are pretty unpleasant. It basically turns into a 720p experience if you want to have what Kyle and the crew consider playable frame rates on Battlefield 5. They did their usual in-depth thing, but you know, even at low settings, 1080p is alarmingly the frame rates aren't particularly playable with the ray tracing turned on. You know, will we see another big bump in ray tracing performance from a driver update? Possibly, but I think after that big huge bump we saw at the beginning of December, I'm not holding my breath on a lot of huge ray tracing performance jumps. It'll be curious to see, you know, as Sebastian was hinting at, you know, as more games come online, as more games where ray tracing was part of the engineering in a much earlier phase of the development of the game, we might see better boosts in performance. But there's just not much out there. And I was thinking about that because, you know, I've been waiting for so long to buy a small card. And with the 2060 release. We saw the first short 2016-2070s. Now, I know most of you don't care about that, but I got digging into mostly Newegg, a little bit of dipping into Amazon prices, but Newegg tends to, you know, have a more consistent, better price supply of GPUs compared to Amazon. And right now, it's really starting to look like it's time to just give up on the GTX series cards, unless you're looking for something at the 1050 level and you can't possibly wait. You know, but when you're looking at a GTX 1080 Ti, if you can find one, they're $900 and up. 1080s are starting at $500. And at that point, you can get into an entry-level 2070 and possibly overclock that to get even better performance. You know, RTX 2080s are anywhere between $660 and $900. The RTX 2070s, like I just said, in the $500 to $600 range. You know, a $500 RTX 2070 to me is looking like a way better purchase than a GTX 1080 or even a GTX 1080 Ti, given that, you know, the 2070 is selling for about the same price as the 1080 Ti, or excuse me, the 1080, and the 1080 Ti's are pretty much in unobtainium land. At that point, you should be thinking about spending a couple hundred dollars more and getting an RTX 2080 Ti if you're looking for the ultimate in performance right now. Yeah. GTX 1060 prices are all over the map. I'm not even going to talk about 3 gigabyte cards, because I'm just a little more forward-looking.
But it's time to move on.
Yeah, I mean, 6 gigabyte cards, they're anywhere from $230 to $370. So if you have no interest in ray tracing and you are bound and determined to stay in the 1080p gaming world for a while, those $230, $250 1060s are looking good. But if you are anywhere near 1440p or are you looking, you know, towards a monitor upgrade, it's not a great ray tracing card, but in terms of performance, you're going to get a big bump in performance spending $350 on an RTX 2060.
It always pays to wait if you want to see, like, what if you want the market to be totally saturated at every price point and every segment, and like whatever's coming from NVIDIA plus whatever's coming from AMD, because they've promised like a full lineup refresh across the board. And we'll have new Vega stuff. So, you know, if you want to wait, then, like, you know, by all means, you'll see more options in this next generation of cards. But right now, if you have to buy a graphics card right now, I would maybe cut the budget on a few more components and buy like a 2060 before I would even think about going previous generation, unless you just get an amazing deal or find a great deal on like a used one.
It seems right now, and there certainly are some deals on used video cards. You know, I have a friend with 35 video cards that he's trying to decide how to best get rid of.
Yeah.
Now that his coin mining operation has been stripped down. But, you know, this is, you know, you're going to be, I would probably at this point would be looking at something 30 to 50 plus percent below the MSRP for a GTX card. Just because, and try to look for the cards that had the longer extended warranty and the better components on board, if you know it's coming out of a mining operation, just to make sure you don't, you know, flame out a card in 6 months and get really, really pissed off about where your money went. Yeah, it's interesting to watch it stabilize. I'm really curious how long it's going to be before we see that, something in the sort of 1050-ish range, or 2050-ish range, or the proposed non-ray tracing, you know, 1066, 1016, 1060.5, whatever crazy numbering scheme, or the 1160. I think we went through, you know, all the permutations of 60 point something last week. I don't know. It's starting to feel like it's safe to buy a GPU again at this point. Unless
you don't want to spend. You know, there's always, there's always going to be buyer's remorse just when you commit to something and then something else comes out like a week or a month later. But that's the nature of the business. That's the way it's always been. That's why I always used to sell everything and buy a new system every 6 months.
That's crazy. Dedication.
Yeah. I wanted the newest and shiniest that I could get.
I mean, I have a friend of mine that is compiling such huge amounts of code that for him, he literally every time there's a measurable bump in SSD performance, and it slowed down, but for a while it seemed like he was upgrading his drives like every 6 months because it gave him measurable amounts of time back in terms of the week because the files he was working with were so massive. But most of us don't have that kind of need. But since we're talking about storage and speed, you guys got your hands on Samsung's 970 Evo Plus. What's the word?
Just real quick, you can read the full review at PC Per, but the important thing about this is that this is an Evo drive, and typically those have been, compared to the Pro drives, kind of like just a little bit below, but at a more attractive price point. You weren't getting the same write speeds, even if you had some of the same really fast read speeds, and there were various reasons for that. This drive is the 970 Evo Plus. And what the Plus does is basically take you into Pro territory. If you compare this head-to-head against the 970 Pro, this has really, really fast write speeds. It takes those fast reads where you're almost saturating PCIe Gen 3, and then you have some really high writes. Not just sequentials. Like, this does really well on, like, random, like, 4K reads and writes as well. So, I mean, you can scroll through and on the review and look at some of the charts. We expanded a little bit back into some of the territory that we've seen in the past. Not quite as comprehensive as maybe like a more in-depth review would be. This is just like a quick kind of preview review, but just to give you like a look at what this thing can actually do. And it's pretty impressive. We're talking about when you're within that turbo cache range, and that's how these Evo drives kind of work. Like, you have sort of a simulated SLC cache, like partition of the drive, and once that is exceeded, which you can only really do through really long sustained workloads, then it kind of comes back down to earth, and you're talking like 1700 megabytes a second or something. But until then, you're talking about reads and writes over 3000 megabytes a second. Very impressive. This was the 1 terabyte version that we tested. Pricing, this is not on the market yet. That's the thing. Like, the review embargo is up and all these reviews are out for it, but it's not actually in stores, I think, until next month. So right now, what we saw a little bit earlier in the month from Western Digital's brand new high performance 1 terabyte drive is somewhere around $299 MSRP, $249 street. So it'll be interesting to see if this competes with that as far as pricing goes. But for a 1 terabyte drive, and I was looking at Newegg yesterday at pricing, I think the least expensive 1 terabyte drive is around $200. Could be wrong about that. Somewhere in that range. I believe it's an Intel drive, like a 660. So we're getting really, really good performance out of this next generation of NVMe drives. Kind of like, it feels like it's at the tail end of PCIe Gen 3. But
right.
That's kind of what we saw at the end of the SATA heyday, is that we just started seeing controllers from almost everyone hitting basically the limits of the interface, where at this point, almost any NVMe drive you pick up is good. Like, yeah, just get one. They're all good. You're not going to have any problems. But especially if you can spend a little bit more and get one of these more premium drives.
Right. I mean, they're talking about $130 for a 500 gigabyte model at this point. Actually, is that up? Hold on. May have finally shown up on Amazon.
Okay.
970 Evo?
It's the Evo Plus.
Ah. They linked to the wrong
one. I don't
think
they're out there yet. Interested to see what pricing will be like.
Yeah. You and me both. We had some fun on Tech Thing this week, or I should say actually last week. Shannon's in New Zealand right now at a Linux conference, and we had some fun getting ready for that because we've had some crazy responses to people that wanted to run Linux on their laptop, but people have been really uptight about whether or not Linux will run on any laptop. Should they go with a Union 76 system? Should they go with the developer's edition from Dell? And we had a MateBook X Pro in, and Shannon grabbed the latest download of Ubuntu from Canonical, fired it up, and had some tremendous success in getting it. She has been loath to install Linux on any of a number of laptop systems because of how bad it was not too long ago. But it seems like the driver support has gotten much better, and the Linux support has gotten much better inside of those. So if you're kind of curious about running Linux on a non-Linux oriented laptop, take a look at this week's tech thing. I also thought it was interesting because I was in a conversation with a bunch of hackers last night, and one of the big things that everybody is so amped up on one side of the fence in the pen testing community because they offer so many flaws and holes and ridiculous lack of security and protection is the Internet of Things, or as I will call it for the remainder of this next couple minutes, the Internet of Stuff. And you guys had an article where Canonical's finally, or I shouldn't say Canonical's finally, Canonical's taken lead on coming out with that stripped down version of Ubuntu called Core 18, where and it's a long-term support version, so it's going to be around for a long time, where the idea is not only will you have a secure operating system run on IoT gear, but updates will be available, and then you know, patches will be released simultaneously. I'm kind of really curious how they're going to implement this, how it's going to work long term. They talked about there might be a cost associated with some devices, you know, so basically that the user base can pay to keep support coming for stuff that maybe wasn't very popular, or if the product is discontinued, or if the product's never particularly well supported from the manufacturer. Open source, free to download. Preview came out in December. Really good article up on the Inquirer that you guys linked to for that one as the source. I am very, very curious to see where this ends up, you know, because Canonical is doing a lot of good work. And this is an area where what we're seeing on so many of these devices is, you know, software that was supposed to be an example from the manufacturer going to the actual physical manufacturing facility, generally somewhere in China, which is being picked up by the, you know, what I will call the marketer who claims to be the manufacturer, who kind of slaps maybe their logo on the software and verifies that it mostly runs, doesn't do any kind of security auditing or testing, and then sells it on Amazon or some other place. You know, it's worth keeping an eye on things, especially if actually, I would normally say, especially if you're at the low end, because a lot of the inexpensive products where you see the same sort of looking device under six or seven brands, a lot of them are fighting a really, really tight margin, so you're not really seeing much in the way of security. But as we're seeing with Nest and other high-end product lines, even though they have charge a premium price, they don't seem to be paying much attention to security. So beware. You know. You know, we used to joke about light bulbs being a vector for getting onto a network, but it's not actually a joke anymore. It hasn't been for a long time. Foxconn.
As a footnote. Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, go for
it.
Just
a footnote about Linux in general. I have myself watched over just the last, it seems like just the last couple of years, support has gotten so good where you can pretty much just install it on anything, laptop. I've done a bunch of mini PC installs with just whatever, like Ubuntu 16 and now 18. And everything works. Like the wireless card works. I had, you know, at least some sort of rudimentary driver support for the graphics. And that's kind of the one pain point, I think, still where depending on what graphics card you have, if you have like a discrete graphics card, what kind of support you have, depending on the vendor and that sort of thing. But it's gotten so much better where I wouldn't even think anything of it. Like it, over the last holiday, I think I encouraged a relative to just blow away their Windows. They didn't like Windows 10. I'm like, just try Linux on it. What's the worst that could happen? Like, I showed them how they could restore their Windows 10 easily, even if they erased their hard drive, and how like the product key is kind of baked into the system now. And so he was able to, with confidence, install Ubuntu, and then everything worked. Like his wireless card was working. Everything he wanted to do on the laptop, he could do. So like, you know, it's especially for lower cost devices. Like there are $200 laptops out there that you could pair with Ubuntu and have a pretty secure, pretty, you know, streamlined experience that would work a little bit better than maybe trying to run a full-on Windows 10 install, especially with like dual core, low power, like those 1.1 gigahertz Celeron processors that are just, you know, I mean, that's what inhabit these $200 laptops, but
it's just like a real processor, except for feeling painfully slow. I was also laughing. Another thing we talked about was We had a viewer who has an older Core i7-920 desktop or 960 desktop that they basically just use to play podcast and host some video in the background of their workstation. And they were like, you know, it's really hot. I have this small room and it's really hot and it seems to consume a lot of power. And it was hysterical looking at the numbers for those first gen Core i7s where it was a 100-watt part. Sometimes they were idling as high as 130 watts. They would hit like 200 watts if you managed to get all the cores running at full speed or at 100%. And then looking at the performance of today's parts, and especially looking at how much work has been done, whether you're talking about Intel or AMD, in terms of minimizing the amount of power consumed at idle, it's crazy to realize what would take 100 to 130 watts at idle. You know, now you're getting a significantly greater amount of work being done, you know, for a fifth, an eighth of the power consumption. That was kind of fun to look at. We heard some rumors last year that Foxconn might be expanding to India, whether that was to deal with the tariffs or to deal with the lack of an available labor pool in China for them to draw on. But, according to the Wall Street Journal, they are getting serious about it. And they are planning to bring the iPhone assembly into India and, sort of smear around iPhone production to additional locations around the world. Wired had an interesting take on Android phones, and, phone sales are down. Flagship phone sales are down.
Yes.
Apple's been hammered. I think LG's had some issues for a while. Samsung, I think, has been hammered a bit. They have a whole article talking about get ready for weird phones, which I am alternately subtitling what manufacturers do when sales drop through the floor. And something that's
holding devices. Was really cool.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one to look at CES. But just as soon as you got used to that, Xiaomi had what they call a double folding phone.
Yes, I saw
which
this
kind
video.
Of folds into three layers, which just to look at is incredibly surreal and slightly terrifying. There it is. It looks.
Yeah, I feel like it's worth watching the video just to see how kind of awkward it seems from a control standpoint, because as he's holding the phone up, it's like, what is being ignored and where exactly are the inputs being registered based on, he has fingers on the back of the device, the side of the device, the front of the device.
He's not wearing headphones, so the answer isn't just to do Bluetooth. Meizu Zero announced a phone this week that literally has no jacks whatsoever. There are two pinholes in the entire phone, one of which is for the microphone. The other one is for the reset button, which had me giggling. There's no buttons. There's no headphone jack. There's no power jack. It's wireless charging. It's Bluetooth for your headset. It is all screen controls. And using an eSIM, and apparently one of the biggest problems with them rolling this out in China, which is where the sales on this are going to start, is that eSIMs aren't particularly well supported in most of China. And I was like, that's one way to make sure you can, reach production and capacity. But it looks, it's kind of curious to look at because it is absolutely tiny. And, part of me is, this is kind of like laying down a gauntlet, like, hey, Apple, you thought you were eliminating all of the ports.
And Apple responds by releasing a phone that doesn't have a display. You're like, ha!
Could be. Well, this one, this is kind of behaving like the Sony OLED TVs that came out last year, where the screen itself acts as a speaker. So the screen on this phone is acting as a speaker. I'm very curious as to how functional and or awkward that will be when sort of all of the audio is coming, most of the audio is going into your cheek, perhaps, or maybe you hold the phone all the way up over your ear, or maybe you just use a headset, get your Bluetooth on. Pricing
information
is a little.
You have to actually press it into your ear to hear audio.
Just wait until they're implanting phones at the mall, man. Well the malls won't be there.
You know that's coming.
They're implanting phones at the big box store.
All we need is a tiny device that connects to Amazon, and then we just, have a guide us, and we don't even need to look at a screen, and she can read me my text messages. And, you know,
Bezos doesn't.
Why do we need these giant things in our pocket? We just need voice and from an implant in our heads.
All you need is a jack just at the top of the skeleton, at the base of the, or the top of the spinal column, at the base of the skull, and just let Amazon take care of you. Amazon will deliver your scop.
Just give in. My body is going to have like Amazon buttons on it, like paper towels, laundry detergent. You know. Or when I think it'll just be ordered.
Oh, man. If you've been looking for a less expensive Pixel 3, The Verge found some. Well, I just like this line, quote, and let me, Sam Byford wrote this up for The Verge. Quote, at this point, it may be a tradition that new Google phones show up in unboxing videos from Eastern Europe before they've even been announced. So this is the so-called Pixel 3 Lite. And there's been a lot of leaks about this. But apparently Andro News got one. You know, the video was removed from YouTube, but it was downloaded, copied, and reposted. And very, very plasticky, possibly. Snapdragon 670, 4 gigs of RAM, pretty chunky bezels above and below. I'm curious, especially that there apparently appears to be a headphone jack on this.
Yes, so. The return of the headphone jack. And you know what? Those you say chunky bezels, but at the same time, no notch, you know?
I'm not a big fan of the notch.
I'm not either. And when I see bezels, and I haven't looked at this yet, I saw some pictures that Paul Thurrott posted about this phone on his website. But if it has those like dual front firing stereo speakers, I love those things on my Nexus 6. So,
yeah.
I'd be okay impressive. With that. Looks kind of all glass on the front, though. I don't know if I see a second speaker.
Well, you never. Maybe the speaker is the glass is the speaker. The other thing, Motorola apparently accidentally leaked all of the specs for their G7, G7 Plus, G7 Power, and G7 Play. We put the right link into the show notes for that one. From the oops, we didn't mean to do that department. Motorola basically accidentally leaked their entire G7 line. CNET picked that up and grabbed some screen caps. On the Brazilian website for Motorola employees, which now 404s, but very curious to see what the camera ends up looking like on that G7. And
yeah, it's certainly got a big enough footprint to be a bigger sensor. That's a pretty large camera opening in the back there.
They're talking about like on the G7 Plus, 16 megapixel f1.17 aperture. 12 megapixel on the standard G7. And it's also funny because they released different versions of the phone or different models and different memory amounts or different amounts of system memory in and outside of the United States. Although it was odd because there was a European-only G6 that had like 6 gigabytes of memory instead of 3, which was not supposed to be sold in the U.S., but it was actually being sold in a legitimate warrantied version on Amazon for a while. So apparently those restrictions are fungible and sponge-like. But, 4 gigabytes of RAM on these, 3,000 milliamp hour batteries, pretty basic 4G LTE, Bluetooth 5, Wi-Fi, 802.11ac. The less expensive models are still running Bluetooth 4.2 and 802.11n. And,
I will say, just for a little context for those who don't know, Mobile World Congress is actually pretty early this year, and it's coming up at the end of February. So
that's fast.
There's a reason why we're starting to see all these mobile phone leaks, and I'm sure Motorola is thrilled that their MWC presentation has been kind of previewed already.
Previewed, annotated, analyzed.
Yeah.
Mocked, dismissed, embraced. did you see... And this was crazy. Somebody actually managed to do, is this a real-time video game playable of Quake 2 in ray tracing and RTX?
Yes. Yes. And I see these links because all the stuff is there. You don't even need the full version of the game. So if you don't have it or don't want to find it or purchase it very inexpensively these days, you can just use the demo. The original Quake 2 demo is fine. And there's actually the link from the developer's page for this project is for like a special version of it that's built on like the Quake 2 Pro, like I think it's an OpenGL engine. But this is a merger basically of two different projects that took like that Quake 2 Pro foundation of like the game running on modern 3D hardware and adds Vulkan path tracing. So this, you know, really enabled by the fact that we have like legitimate, like, you know, ray tracing hardware now to run at high frame rates. This is like a full playable game experience. And I've watched the video and I've looked at the pictures and it looks fantastic. And I'm kicking myself because I haven't installed it myself yet, but I want to.
Yeah, I'm just kind of tripping out on the video. Sorry.
Yeah. I know, Quake 2 was one of those games where, I mean, John Carmack did incredible things within the hardware limitations that he faced. And this is right. More than 20 years old. This game came out in December of 1997. So we're talking about a 21-year-old game where he was doing like real-time lighting and stuff right in the engine. And now, you know, some of the scenes is kind of subtle. Like what we're watching now, but they're like the explosions, that sort of thing. You can really see. It's just so much more kind of immersive looking. Like light really does act the way that it's supposed to. And even with these lower polygon count characters and things, like the game shows its age a little bit, but it's still fun, and it looks better than ever. So, hats off to the people who, you know, just as a side project, without being paid a penny, have made this happen. And this is like, these projects began, like the foundation of this is going all the way back to like 2006. So
that's pretty crazy and pretty epic. Oh my goodness. Something I didn't expect to see, and I'm going to throw a shout out to this. By the way, if you are a Sonos enthusiast or have been thinking about Sonos, there are a bunch of their products that are on sale at Sonos.com, pretty significant discounts, especially if you've wanted but never been willing to pony up the money for the Sonos sub. That's like $100 off that right now. Bloomberg's reporting that Sonos is going to be doing a wireless over-ear headphone maybe next year, somewhere in that, you know, magic $300 price range that was set down by Beats. I'll be very curious to see if they do that. You know, the thing, you know, Bloomberg, of course, being a financial publication, notes first is they're looking for new markets after the IPO. And I feel like they rewrote that after I, you know, it's early and it's relatively private at this point. But I'd be very curious to see if Sonos actually decides to move into the already incredibly crowded and kind of difficult headphone market. YouTube TV, this is, if you've been thinking about cable or thinking about how you want cable but don't want to pay cable prices, YouTube TV finally went nationwide. And pretty good summary of this by Chris Welch over at The Verge. But you're looking at 98% of the United States, like the top 100 U.S. markets, were already had access. 95 more markets are being added. So if you've been looking for, you know, a lot of channels for not much money and you have decent internet service, this is probably a good way to go. It's kind of crazy how, how many channels you're getting for the $40 a month you're paying right now. And they've done some interesting stuff. It's $40. There's no minimum commitment. You don't have to sign up for a year. Every household, you get 6 accounts for the household. Everybody gets their own login. Everybody gets their own DVR. You have to schedule your recording or start on time. You know, they have unlimited amount of storage, so you can pretty much capture the shows you want and watch them forever. But if you've never seen it, it's like, you know, ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, AMC, BBC America, BBC World News, you know, Cheddar, Big News, Bravo, BTN, Cartoon Network, CNBC, MSNBC Sports, CBS Sports Network, CNN, like the list goes on. Disney, Disney XD, Disney Junior, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN University, ESPN News, all of the Fox flavors, National Geographic, Nat Geo Wild, the Smithsonian Channel, NBA TV. And then there's, you know, if you want to pay a little bit extra, Fox Soccer Plus is like $15 a month. The NBA League Pass is $40 a month or $124 a year. Showtime is $7 a month. Stars is $9 a month. You know, there's if you've been looking for a viable low cost cable replacement, I think a lot of people will be pretty happy with this one, and just about everybody can get access to it now.
I was going to say, I can't watch a YouTube video anymore, I think, on my phone without a little message I have to dismiss at the bottom saying, try YouTube TV today. I'm like, not right now, but it'll remind me again in an hour, so that's fine.
Yeah, I've been realizing I'm finally going to pony up for YouTube Premium just so I can eliminate the ad experience.
Was it like $10 a month? I think,
you know, $11.99 a month.
I don't know why that bothers me so much that it's $10 a month, because it used to be bundled in with their Google Play Music plan as like a free bonus when it was called YouTube Red. But I watch enough YouTube that I think I would appreciate not having to watch ads.
Well, this is interesting. Oh, my goodness. Okay, there it is. Sorry, I logged into the wrong YouTube account. It was like not available. No. And I'm like, why? Why? And then I realized I was in the Techzilla account, not my first account. But they do have family and student plans.
Student plan is cheaper. It's $5.99 a month for students.
You'll be redirected to Sheer ID to verify your student status.
No, it's worth going back to school just to save $4 a month.
Well, technically, YouTube. We are a school. We homeschool here.
Oh, there you go. Out what,
you know, so the kids can watch Crash.
Start getting some of that tax money or something, which I obviously that doesn't work that way, but you know,
it's a dream. I also wanted to get your reaction. Have you seen Scout, the new little blue robot from Amazon?
No, when you said like Scout, you mean from VPI, the turntable? Yeah, I love that thing. But no.
What you're talking about here?
Yes, I saw this. I saw something about this just on the news yesterday.
All I could think was, you know, this is going to be such a target for hackers and such a target for anybody. You know, all I can think is like, okay, I see all the cameras, because you can see a big collection of cameras arrayed around. Sort of the blue part stops, and there's sort of a black rim that runs around it, and you can see all sorts of sensors or cameras down there. What appear to be turn signals built into the side. I'm just looking at this, and all I can think is, you know, given how much people love to steal packages off of porches, like, how long is it going to take for someone to wail on this thing with a sledgehammer, or, you know, or just throw the thing into the back of their truck? I'm sure it'll be tracked if they do that, but, you know, will there be defensive capabilities built into it? What happens if it gets knocked over? What happens when children start riding it? But, you know, I look at that lid and all I can think is like, man, people are just going to be popping those lids off and grabbing whatever's inside of this.
It needs to be armored if it's really going to be. Like, I don't want a high-value package delivered by this tiny thing. It comes and it's like the lid is missing. It's covered in, like, battle scars and soot from, like, explosives and bullet holes.
It's funny. There's a big battle going on. Bird, which is one of those personal transportation companies where you put an app on your phone and you rent time on an electric scooter, are in a big battle with Boing Boing, because Boing Boing pointed out that a lot of these scooters got basically picked up by the cops, and the fees on them are so high for the towing that you can actually buy them out of auctions for not much money. And then it turns out it's a relatively standardized scooter that you can pick up, I want to say off of Alibaba, you can pick up non-Bird gated controllers, and Bird's like, this is a violation of the DMCA and you have to pull down this article. And I was laughing because, you know, just a couple days ago, somebody left one of the Bird scooters in my neighbor's lawn, which my son found and then put down to the corner so somebody else could find it. But they had ripped the entire control unit off the top. They had ripped the control units off the base. They had stolen the batteries to repurpose them and basically turned it into a dumb scooter, which is not motorized, but still perfectly functional. And that's, I'm kind of very curious to see what happens with a lot of this stuff, because we've seen a lot of, for example, the scooters, You know, some of them have been run over. Some of them have been intentionally vandalized. There's this, you know, a certain portion of the hardware desiring market who has looked at the scooters as being an inexpensive source of lithium ion batteries. You know, because they have the moral flexibility that allows them to steal these. Although I heard a hysterical conversation while I was waiting to get on the bus a few weeks ago involving someone in my, you know, very law and order-ish kind of town, basically being like, they were so pissed off at these ride sharing devices and bicycles being left everywhere and scooters being abandoned that they were okay with recompensating or, you know, compensating themselves by stealing hardware from a manufacturer. But
yeah, we talked about this on Twit on Sunday. I was on there and this was a subject because of, you know, the Cory Doctorow angle and the claims. But you know what, Patrick, I think we're almost out of time.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, let us remind you that you are listening to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. We talk about hardware. We talk about all the hardware and all the hardware news we can fit into the show. If you've never heard the show before, do yourself a favor. Go over to twit.tv/Twitch, and you will find yourself with all of the older episodes or a tremendous more than you can listen to in the next couple of weeks and all the information on how to subscribe. If you haven't been there, go to pcper.com. That is Sebastian Peake's home on the internets. You can find me over at AVXL or techthing.com. We want to thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, and we hope we'll see you again next week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Horton.
I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.